This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Great. Well, one of the reasons that I get to do this talk is that I was lucky enough to be sent on a gardening internship to Japan 26 years ago by our sister city. You all know the name of the sister city in Japan? It's Awita. And I will be showing you why they know that. So, like many of these, I'm going to start out with comparing and contrasting the Eastern versus Western gardens. And here we have Nara Castle in Kyoto, and you'll see the difference here between this and Vilandri. Both of these gardens are totally man-made. Both of these are totally artificial. But you can see or maybe sense that there's a different attitude towards nature in the Eastern gardens versus the Western gardens. One is trying to recreate perfect beauty, and the other one is trying to show their control of plants to create something of beauty. The plant materials are dealt with differently too. Both of these have basically tortured these plants, but here in Japan, the end result is they want this to look like something that has been swept by the winds, the result of natural experiences, whereas here, they're using the plant materials to create a man-made design. You also find that in Japanese gardens, they really go for seasonal color, not our usual, this is Monet's gardens in Giverny, not riotous displays of color, or like an English perennial garden where you're making sure that there's going to be something blooming at every time of the day. Another big difference you'll find is in water features. You will never find in a Japanese garden a geometrically designed pond or pool. They will have, sometimes they'll have them in the shape of ideograms, like the word for heart is very prized. But you will, if you have a water feature, this is about as unnatural as it gets with the bamboo pipe here. The other big difference, and this is in Versailles in the Orangerie, in a Japanese garden, you will never see the whole garden at once. Whereas a lot of Western gardens are designed to be viewed overhead. But that's very contrary to the way the Japanese design theirs. So here we have Niju Castle, and we're trying to recreate nature and natural beauty. And here, this is in Bilbao. Any of you been there to the Guggenheim? That's Puppy, by the way. That was supposed to be a temporary art installation, and the people of Bilbao loved it so much that they bought it, and they keep this blooming like this year round. Kind of astonishing. And for the most part, Western gardens are secular and have nothing to do with their religion. One small exception are, this is at the Alhambra, but in Muslim gardens, the waterways are laid out to reflect their belief that civilization was created at the confluence of two rivers. So you'll often have two channels and a fountain in the middle. So it's interesting that this is a church that we're having this, because the thing about Japanese gardens is you cannot separate them from their religion. And a very interesting thing that the Japanese have done through the years is that they have incorporated many different influences, but religious ones, and they didn't throw out the old ones. They just overlap them and build on to what they already believe. And so the primitive religion, and it isn't primitive in that sense, but the original one was Shintoism. And in Shintoism, you get the concept that natural objects are the abode of spirits. And for example, what they're showing here is their veneration of this wonderful ancient tree by tying it with a gold ribbon around it. And here you see, it looks like you're wearing little cocktail waitress aprons there. Those are actually baby bibs. And so that's showing us that these have very young spirits inside of them. And in fact, many places you go, you'll see the baby bibs or the little faces. These are all young spirits. So after Shintoism, Buddhism came in, and it was 2 centuries before Buddhism started effecting garden design. But it was such, they incorporated this so extremely that it turned out that only you had to understand the Buddhist rules and principles, and only priests could create gardens. And they had a name for them, Ishitatetsu, and they were stone-setting priests. And with Buddhism came this idea of symbolism in the garden. So for example, this is at the Imperial Palace. This shore here, that represents here and now, our present life. And across the pond, that is the afterworld. And the bridges represent the difficult path we take transitioning between this world and the afterworld. Whoops. That one should bam. Yeah. I don't know how there's so many pictures that I don't get them all. So here we go. Here's the difficult path between this life and the next. You also get symbolism. And in fact, this is at Nara. In Japan, the deer are considered messengers to the gods, and so they're revered. The crane is a symbol of long life. So when you see one, when you're visiting the garden, you're supposed to have that symbol spark in your mind. And then, of course, the most symbolic plant of all to the Japanese is the lotus, because its roots are mired in the mud, kind of like the human condition and all of our faults and foibles, and it raises its flowers and its leaves to receive enlightenment, symbolic of enlightenment, which is, of course, what the Buddha is symbolic of. So therefore, because gardens became inextricably linked with their religion, they were built usually at temples. And just like when you go into church and you confess your sins and you wash yourself clear of everyday life, at the entrance to all the gardens, there is always a place to wash your hands. And there is a very ritualistic way to do it. So you wash the people in front of you because they scoop and they wash one hand and they wash the other, and then they scoop and then let the water run down the bottom so that it's clean for the next person. We brought a bunch of these back for the botanical gardens and never dared put any out because they would not have, they would have been swiped right away. I hate to bring that out. And these lanterns, this is the actually sort of the idealized version of one of the lanterns. You have the stones set in an ocean or a sea of stones, and then they've stuck that little bit of clematis there. And every garden has them. And the other thing they do is these, whoops, why did that happen? Wait a minute. Okay. These wide expanses of gravel, those are used for ceremonial purposes, and they're supposed to show that that's a revered or sacred space. And also, as you'll see later, they're outside of them, because this is considered a sacred space, they often have places for people to write their little invocations, their wishes, or their prayers, and they can post them here to make sure that the gods who come by will get their messages. They also often have incense that you can light, and you pay the monks there a little bit of money and you get incense. And you have to watch very carefully, because there's a ritual to that too. You never blow it out. You have to shake it out, because the whole point of the incense is to take your misses up to the gods. And another legacy of this association with religion are lanterns. Lanterns were used for all night vigils. This is in Inara. One night a year, all of these lanterns, and there are thousands under in the understory, are lit. I can't, it's sort of like our Dia de los Muertos here. So we had Shinto and we had Buddhism, and then we get Zen. And the effect of Zen was to take gardens totally into the abstract. And they were considered gardens of the mind. This is Ryōan-ji. It's a group of 15 stones in five different configurations. And you go to this temple, take off your shoes, and there's a long platform where you sit. And the idea is that you're going to contemplate the garden. Now, according to Zen, I can't tell you what this means. It's supposed to come out of your own mind. But I'm going to cheat and tell you that they've suggested these are either islands sticking out of the sea or mountains piercing the clouds. It's whatever you think it is. But part of these karasansui, they call them, they're dry landscapes of raked gravel. Part of the discipline of the monks is raking this gravel. And if you can imagine trying to do that in Texas, you'd have leaves in it every single day. They're out there early in the morning. It's quite something. It's part of the monk's training. So the thing I didn't realize until I'd been to Japan was that the tea ceremony was so linked to Zen. Because the idea in Zen is that everything you do in your life reflects your spiritual enlightenment or awareness, even the preparation of a simple cup of tea. And then what I didn't realize is that the garden, the tea garden, is part of the whole preparing for the ritual. So we were invited to a private garden, and you can see here what they do before you arrive. They rinse the whole thing down. They also clean up every single leaf, and then they shake the tree so that there are a few leaves so it doesn't look unnatural. But you're invited in, and as you pass through the gates, you are symbolically passing from the everyday mundane world we all live in into the deeply spiritual world of the garden. And you'll see this is all built in an alleyway in a very tight urban situation, but you wouldn't imagine, you look at this and you imagine the woods and mountains and being, you don't imagine that you're in an urban situation. But you can see on these stepping stones, they're kind of mossy and wet, and you have to watch very carefully where you're walking. But sure enough, once you come to a flat stone, there is the basin. And this is Mr. Suneki. He is a master gardener, and he's come here many times to Austin to help us with our garden. And he is showing us ritually how to use our little water thing to prepare for the tea ceremony. And then we go into the tea house, and you'll notice here you have to crawl to get in. And the whole idea is to humble yourself before you get to watch the ritual preparation of a cup of tea. It takes years to learn how to do this. And if you are lucky enough to ever be invited to do that, you just be quiet and watch what everybody else does, because it's very, very easy to do the wrong thing, put your cup down the wrong way. Oh, and while you're in there, also there's a scroll that has sort of the message of the day. And I think, you know, probably there's something in your program for church today that's got something like that, something that you should be thinking about. So this is that same tea garden, and you can see we're coming around the house. Every stone is placed so thoughtfully. You have not only this stone here, which is where you would sit to take your shoes off before you go in the house. But you got your French drain that's going to catch the water coming off the eaves. And this one, they have actually a very high basin. That's not considered very thin because it reflects your social status, and you should really have to bend over and show your humbleness and not be better than other people. So just a few more lanterns, as I was saying. Every place has, that one moved faster than it was supposed to. There we go. There's beautiful, everyone is unique. Oh, you know what, it's moving itself, I don't know why. Okay, the other thing is stepping stones. And you will notice that the stepping stones are always placed so that you can't see where you're going. That's to lend mystery to it. You're never gonna see the whole garden. And when you see a crooked path like that, that's because they believe the devil can only walk in straight lines. So that if you have crooked lines, you can evade the bad. This one was especially bizarre. And when there is a path and there's a place to stop, there's always something they want you to think about. So what I'm kind of setting up for you is that they want to control your experience, and it gives them a lot of flexibility. One last thing, this came from China, is the color vermilion, because most of these gardens are totally green. All these torii gates are painted orange, which gives you immediate contrast. This is Fushimi Inari Shrine. This goes up, maybe it's more than a couple miles up into the hills, and people kind of do the pilgrimage of walking through, and people have posted these. Each one is in honor of some ancestor. And there's more of that vermilion. Whoops, why did it, I don't know why it's doing that. Okay. So one thing that I didn't see in any of the Japanese garden books, and I brought some of my books here for any of you who are interested in them, was from the Japanese tea garden, we get this concept of a stroll garden, of movement through the garden. And I never saw a book that took you through one garden just to show you how they do that. And this is Ginkakuji, the silver pavilion in Kyoto. And wait a minute, I think, yeah, I have to go back. As you enter, you see how they've created this mystery? You can't see where you're going. This is on purpose. They want this experience to unfold the way they've designed. So as you go through, you'll notice this is sort of a hybrid. It's my favorite because it's got the karasansui, the raked gravel, but also it's a stroll garden. And as I was saying, as you walk through, anytime you get to a place where there's a large stone, you know there's something you're supposed to be looking at. So, I think we're still walking through. Now, I've been there in the summer, and then the last time we went, it was in the fall. And I have a couple of pictures here that show you the difference, because they're still predominantly green. We're still walking through. Whoops, I didn't even do that one. And here, I think it's the next picture. There it is in the summer, and there it is in the fall, a few years different. So being very Zen, you know, you're supposed to contemplate this. And these monks have gone to a lot of work to create this. But I'm not supposed to tell you what it means. It's supposed to be what you conjure up in your mind, the significance. The buck stops here, I don't know. So we're still walking past that. You can tell that one's in the fall. And we're walking up the hill, and there's every place you stop, there's something they want you to look at. Come on. There we go. And up the hill. Sometimes this thing has a mind of its own. Okay, another place. And then you get to the top of the hill and look at this. They're going to have to come here and do a little bit of trimming, but they have this perfect view down on part of that Karasim Sui and perfect view back. And you come down the hill, beyond the garden, they have this very scary, dark-looking forest on the other side. Down the hill, and down the hill. So they've created a whole little walk for you through the whole garden. I guess that one's in the fall. So how do you create a Japanese garden? And what things can you take to incorporate in your own gardens? Well, unlike the way we garden here, where my poor husband has to take a pickaxe to get stones out, you start with the stones. It's the first thing in Japanese gardens. And this is their equivalent of Williams-Sonoma. You can go and pick out. Wouldn't you love it if you had that choice? These stones are buried. Most of the stone is buried. In fact, the word for the bottom of the stone is the same as the word root. Because remember, they have their own spirits inside of them. And the way you arrange the stones is very important. The classic way is with three stones. You use 3, 5, 7, 9. You never use 4. The word for is so similar to the word for death that it's avoided. But when you have three stones, usually the tallest is heaven. Then you have a flat one that's earth. And then man, heaven, earth, man. And they have big ceremonies when stones arrive. They'll wrap them and have them delivered, and there'll be a big party. But once again, when you see that, you're supposed to be reminded, heaven, earth, man. I don't know why this is doing that. Excuse me. I don't know why. Oh, well. There we go. Okay. Well, they were going to give me a clicker, but they thought this would work. That's making it very confusing. Okay. Wabi-sabi. They love anything that has got age, history. What is this? I don't know what's happening. I apologize. Okay, well, whatever. You have to respect the orientation of the stone. And you can see here, if that stone had been put on its side and not respected the way it wanted to be, that would be very bad feng shui. These are supposedly the bases of columns from temples, but there's so many more of them that could ever have existed. There's like a black market on things that they say have historical significance, but don't. But they're highly prized. And that wabi-sabi, what I was going to show you was getting that moss to grow on it, that gives it the appearance of age. So that's a very prized quality. Paving. I have lots and lots of pictures of paving. And this is terrible. This is like my nightmare. Okay. You can almost see that this paving is telling you, slow down, fine. You don't have to worry about it. Whereas this other paving makes me nervous. You have to pay attention. It's stairs that are crooked going down. And it makes me almost feel agitated. And when you look at the different pavers, you can see that they're pacing you through the garden. And the paths always go somewhere that you can't see. Now that has got to be intentional. There's never anything in a Japanese garden that isn't. I took lots and lots of pictures of paving because I'm pretty fascinated by it. And as you can see, it always goes somewhere. They don't want you to know until you get there. Beautiful stuff. See, now it won't go. Oh, here we go. Again, the big gravel expanse. I don't know why it's doing that. I've never had that do that happen before. Big gravel expanse for ceremonial purposes. That is a wedding that was taking place. It was a lot of fun to watch the. It took them about an hour to get one picture. And then talking about stone, this is the medieval Osakujo Castle in Osaka. And just to show you the scale of these stones that were placed here in medieval times, and the way that they're put together, it's not the way we would have, our Western minds, I think, would think about stacking things. Okay, so stone is first, next is water. And the Japanese, it kind of reminds me of hearing that, you know, the Eskimos have all these words for snow. The Japanese have all these words for water. And they pay a lot of attention to it in their gardens. And the first one I have here is Ito-ochi, water that falls in a thin stream. And most prized is if it falls in a thin stream and then hits something and splashes. They try to design those things into their gardens. This is actually a Kiyomizu-dera. This is the temple of pure water, and everyone comes and gets a scoop of the water and drinks, and it's supposed to give you long life. So the next one is Nuno-ochi, which is water that falls in a broad sheet. And then you get Sutai-ochi, which is water that trickles over rocks. A little more Sutai-ochi there. And if you don't have water, that's okay. Because, yeah, they try to copy what water looks like when real water, but making, this is terrible. By creating, so this one's a real one, even though they purposely put those stones there so that the water would play around them and make patterns. And here we have one that is artificial, created. And they also have, now they sell these now in Austin, you can get them in America, but these water chains were a new thing to me. And they hang them off the eaves of the roof so that they catch the water and make it play, make the sound repeat. Okay, then plants. This is very different than the way any of us landscape in this country. They buy plants full size from the nurseries and they keep them that size. So for instance, in the pines, they take out the candles, the new growth, and keep it the same size. Also, we happen to be sent to a landscape place, and we got to see them wrap up this tree. Now, I know if you've ever bought bald and burlap trees in this country, there might be a little piece of burlap and a nail in it or something. They have three guys throwing the rope back and forth in almost a choreographed dance, and within 5 minutes, it looks like that. Wrapped up. The Japanese are experts on wrapping things. So the Japanese are so into their gardens that one of the big debates they have is which season is the best? And the poets write, and it's the opinions in the newspaper. Oh, I don't know which favorite you have. I have never made it to Japan for the cherry blossoms, but if you all are ever in New York, the Brooklyn Botanical Gardens has a huge cherry blossom festival. And in anticipation of it, they have a chart on their website that shows you which trees are blooming, so that you can try and time it to be there when the most trees are blooming. So they depend on summer color, on seasonal color. So in the summer, hydrangeas and water lilies. But you see, the gardens are predominantly green. And personally, I think that fall is the most beautiful. See, these probably are nowhere near a ginkgo or a maple tree, but they have come and sprinkled those leaves in there just for the effect. And if you go in after Thanksgiving is when their fall foliage season starts. So it's a little beyond past ours. I had to take lots of pictures of these. I'm into moss. This is a Tofukuji. Let's see. I should have asked Pat. There we go. Now it's going to probably go three. Okay. And then there's, I'm going to show you winter. We went up to what they call the Japanese Alps. It's a whole village of these little thatched roof cottages. And we had to take a bus, and we were a little worried about that. And we were assured, oh, it never snows in December. Don't worry about it. And we got there, and it was cold, freezing rain. Well, the next morning, first snow of the season. And there were all these people, there were a lot of kids there who had never seen snow before. And everyone was out taking 8,000 pictures of every bit of it. And kids were, had their tongues out and were letting the snow fall on it. It was one of those, it's why you travel, is hoping for something like that. And so a fun thing about Japan is if your computer works, and there we go, you can go and rent a kimono. And it's almost like prom pictures. Everyone is renting these kimonos, and they pose. I didn't change it. Okay, but even the dogs wear kimonos. Somehow the computer is jumping ahead of me. And the school field trips go to gardens. And this is sort of a cute one because my husband wearing his cowboy hat attracts visitors. People, I don't know why. These school children had to interview somebody in English, and they had to each come up and ask us a question. And we, of course, are delighted to do that. They actually sent us a package of letters later thanking us. And so we were able to send them a whole bunch of letters and things about Austin, Texas. But you'll see them on their school holidays at all the gardens. And we got interviewed more than once. So because they control your way through the garden, they're allowed to do something perspective tricks to you. Because Japan is very densely populated. People don't have a lot of rooms. They need to use everything they can to, I'm glad that's still there, to make it look bigger or to play with your perceptions. And because they are controlling where you see from, they can do that. So this is a great example. It's Kinkakuji, the Golden Pavilion. And what they do is that in the foreground, the trees are larger. And as they recede from you, they view, they have them pruned to be smaller and smaller and smaller. So you have the perception that the lake is wider than it is and that it's further away. So there you go. An example of that, and I forget what's behind there. They also layer things so that they look further away. Here's another perspective trick. This is in Owita at the No Theater. And what they do is just like the train tracks, getting the parallel train tracks, they make the water course get less narrow, and they have larger stones in the front, in the foreground, and smaller stones in the background so that it looks like it's further away. And you can see that examples of it everywhere you go. There's another one where they layer things. If you have a lantern that's too big, you put it behind a tree so that it'll look smaller, and you have it. This one has a successful ridges that get smaller as you leave, as it goes further away. Borrowed scenery. This lost a lot in the translation, but right behind there is the famous mountain. If you have a view of something that was written about in literature or whatever, and you create a borrowed scenery or a framed view of it, it's supposed to remind us of the lessons of that particular piece of work. In Owita, this is our sister city, every single tree is pruned. And they say it so that they will withstand typhoons, but you suspect it's more than that. These guys are wearing these little socks and up here, and they're taking the candles out of that pine so that it will stay the same size. So all the new growth is removed. And this is in Kenmokuin Garden. In November of every year, they come through and they tie all of these limbs, because they've created them to have such extreme angles so that they don't break when it snows. They tie them up. And of course, that is beautiful in itself. The Kenmokuin Garden is one of the most famous. It's on the western coast of Japan. And they say it has the six attributes of a perfect landscape: spaciousness, seclusion, artifice, antiquity, water courses, and panoramas. The perfect garden. And you can see the lengths they go to when they train these trees to have these limbs that they can't actually hold up. Or in this case, they want to keep the limbs from impeding your walkway. They also go to incredible lengths to protect the plants. Here, this is in December, and these are sagos, and they have wrapped them for the winter. We don't go to that. And then the maintenance, like I was saying, this is part of their religious discipline, is keeping these gardens clean. This is 5 in the morning in Kyoto. So what kind of inspiration can we take, and what can we take from here to use in our own gardens? Well, the first rule is always to find inspiration from nature. And I took this picture in Montana, and as I was sorting my Japanese slides, I realized it looked very similar to this. So what you would first do is go take a hike somewhere and study the way the water naturally has carved out its own path. This is in Owita, and this had a very similar, I thought, profile to this. And this is our master gardener, Suneki, he created this garden next to this restaurant, and it's maybe 5 feet across. And you look at it from the restaurant, and it looks like you're in there's a mountain stream there. And in our own city, when the prehistoric garden was built in the quarry where they discovered the dinosaur footprints, they found that there was an outcrop of rock, of stone. And so they came through and extended it. And today, they put in water. There was no water in it before. They've got this beautiful waterfall for our dinosaur to roam. So what's this whole idea of miniaturization? You've probably heard of bonsai. Well, it's not just trying to torture a tree, though it is pretty torturous, but it's the idea that you're going to give it a sense of antiquity. This one, all twisted up, this is a plant that has been suffered and it's got the appearance of being very, very ancient. And they've just done this at Zilker. It's just started, but they have created a bonsai exhibition there. But another thing you can do that's similar with the way they play with perspective are miniature gardens, which is my big love right now. And I have a great little book on it here because it's all about working with scale and creating the illusion of something that's a lot bigger. And I do them in little saucers, which would be a great thing to give somebody who's in a nursing home or someplace where they're not gonna have their own garden. And the idea would be you would think about it the same way as if you were walking through a garden. The other thing the Japanese do very well is they use vertical space. And this is Whole Foods has one of these, but these we've been seeing all around the world. It's quite, this is in Madrid, it's quite a trend to have these vertical walls in cities, giving you the green and all the oxygen they produce. That's just a little close-up of it. We're talking about scale. Have you all ever heard of these? This is in Singapore. This is the super trees. And it's taking them the other way with scale. Each one of these, they not only compost in the bottom, they collect rainwater, and they collect solar energy so that every single night there is a sound and light show that's powered by the solar energy that they've collected. It's sort of a great display of natural ecologically correct architecture. How about that? And then in our own town, I don't know how many of you have heard of Isamu Taniguchi. Why is it doing that? Oops. I've never had this happen before. Okay. And now. I apologize. This is like my worst nightmare. I've never had this happen. I don't know what, it's got a mind of its own. Well, let me tell you about Taniguchi. Well, you know, he came and worked here without pay for 18 months to create this garden. And as a gift to the city, and it's sort of amazing because he was one of the people who was put in one of the internment camps, Japanese internment camps, lost his farm, ended up here in the Rio Grande Valley, had to rebuild everything. And he wanted to build it to inspire us to be nonviolent and to live in peace and harmony. And on the tea garden there, you'll see they have this symbol. It's Jin Waten, people, harmony, man. And there's a lovely explanation of how he was worried about nuclear proliferation. And that was in 1969. Now I think we have new worries. And we have a wonderful book. He told this story to Jane Bald and about the mother tree. And she wrote a book about it and said about how this book inspired him while he was building the garden. And in fact, after he finished the garden, it died. And I hate to tell you, this has been vandalized so much, there's very little left of it anymore, which just kind of makes you feel sad. But in Japan, and this is a picture of Japan, when a tree dies, you don't take it out because that's got wabi. That's got this lovely ancient spirit in it. Okay, I gotta do this fast. Okay. This is Mr. Tsunegi, and he's come many times, and he was the reason I got to go to Japan, because he recognized that the garden was losing its character, and he wanted to help teach us how to take care of it better. And he came, and that previous picture, you couldn't see the waterfall. He pruned all these pittosporums so that you would have a view of the waterfall, and also that the structure of the tree was visible. But I took this picture 2 weeks ago during Snowmageddon. We lost big tree and all of the pittosporums died. I mean, which is sad because they'd been there for 40 years or so. And so the garden was opened in 1969, and up at the top is where the water all starts. And then if you walk the whole trail, you see that it goes downhill. One thing Tsunegi realized was that our garden did not have a gate. And so if you don't have a gate, you can't have any transition between the mundane life and the spiritual life of the garden. So in 1999, our sister city gifted us with this gate, and we had that installed. And as many of you may or may not know, Taniguchi Isamu's plan for this was that the ponds would spell out the word Austin. And that's very Japanese. As I said, sometimes the ponds were written in ideograms. And so here we have, you have to use your imagination. This is the A and the U. And then it brings you up to the bridge. The bridge to walk over the moon, as you're halfway through, you're supposed to be there on the night of a full moon. And as you gaze into the reflection of the moon, you get a sense of true beauty. Taniguchi's plan for the koi pond, and I'll show it to you here, it's a sail, a gangplank and a sail, a chain and an anchor. So there's the sail is over here, and there's your chain and anchor. Used to be, this was kids' favorite part of the whole tour. They no longer let kids do this because the kids aren't coordinated enough and they keep falling in the pond. Kind of distressing. Okay, a real quick thing about Awita. Our sister city, I can't thank them enough. They are right on the coast and on the lower island, Kyushu. It was a former Portuguese trading port, and that's why they have this lovely boat. And I wore my cowboy hat when I went 26 years ago, and everywhere I went, people came up to me and said, Austin, Texas, Austin, Texas. I know, how come we don't know Awita? Well, I found out why. The whole trip, our schedule was written out in minutes, and we showed up at 11:59, and at noon every day, the doll clock rings, and they have four different little dolls come out one at a time on different sides, and each one represents one of their sister cities. And for us, Uncle Sam comes out, and anybody want to guess what he what music plays? Beautiful Dreamer. I go figure. Okay. And I'm going to rush through this because you might not be going to Awita, but they also have a mountain called Monkey Mountain. And this was to talk about the food. Someone was mentioning to me they don't like sushi. There's all kinds of different food. You don't have to like raw fish. In Japan, lots of places, it looks like it's gosh, this is terrible. There are fires, but it's actually, you know, it's a volcanic island and they have all these hot springs. And in fact, right outside of our sister city is Umijigoku, which is hell. Welcome to hell. But these are actually very sulfurous and you probably would die if you fell in. But just like I was saying before, anytime there's a place that's obviously sacred, people come and they write their wishes and their misses. And if they don't leave, if they don't provide those places, people will do them right on the trees. This is worse than ball moss on a tree. It will kill it because the leaves can't get any light. And this was just a funny one. Our hotel, our Airbnb in Kyoto, below us, there was a temple. And there was this thing that looked like a big shaggy dog. And the whole time we saw people crawling in or crawling out and friends taking pictures. Turns out, if you are going to form a relationship, you go and you pay the monk and you write your little missive and you crawl through. If you're breaking up or you're dissolving a relationship, people come, write their thing, put it on there, and they crawl backwards to undo the relationship that they forged. And if you go and you stay in a ryokan, they give you these lovely outfits, so you get to pretend you're Japanese, which is a good thing. And then this was the comment about, it's not all sushi. These are shabu-shabu meals where you have the big pot of boiling broth and you dump things in and eat it at the end. And they have little hibachis with barbecue. So you're not stuck. This is candy sushi. You're not stuck with that. Okay.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.